Today, Up, Up and Away, the Property Imperative Weekly, the 22nd of June 2019. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And welcome to our digest of news to the 22nd of June 2019. In this edition, we look at the stock markets still running high, together with gold and Bitcoin, while central banks around the world are competing to take benchmark rates lower and pump yet more cash into the system. And the international risks continue to build, with the events in the Middle East, the trade wars between China and the USA, and more dodgy banking practices all in the mix. And we start with the international scene before looking in more detail at the latest from Australia. And the link to the Australian specific segment is in the comments below if you want to go straight there. But once again, we start global because as a trade-exposed, open, resource-reliant economy, we are caught in the global financial cross-currents, like it or not. But as a precursor, consider this. If we compare the performance of the Dow Jones Index with the ASX 100 over recent years, we can see a stark difference. The Dow has outperformed significantly, despite Australia exiting the GFC without a technical recession, while of course the US reversed, pumped up the economy, and then pulled ahead. Interestingly, returns from Australian firms were about 2%, whereas US stocks have returned 12% over the same period, so this explains some of the differences in performance. The Australian economy is relatively narrow and weak, whereas the US also has a crop of tech firms to help stoke the market, chalk and cheese. In fact, Wall Street edged lower on Friday as US Vice President Mike Pence called off a planned China speech that had been cast initially as a sequel to the blistering broadside he delivered in October. Now, this has been interpreted as a move aimed at averting increasing tensions with Beijing. President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping are expected to restart trade talks at the Group of 20 summit in Japan on June the 28th and 29th. The benchmark S&P 500 index hit an intraday record high of 2,964 and then stepped back as the rising tensions between the United States and Iran kept investors on edge. The possibility of US retaliation pushed crude prices higher and helped lift the energy sector by 0.82%. WTI oil ended up 0.91% on Friday to $57.59, bringing the weekly gain close to 9%, and growing fears that supply out of the Persian Gulf could be disrupted by the standoff between the US and Iran. Any disruptions would further tighten global supply, given that OPEC and its allies plan to extend their existing agreement on output restraint at the beginning of July. At the same time, concerns over the global demand outlook has receded a little on hopes for looser monetary policy and on hopes that US and China will move closer to a trade agreement when the two leaders meet next week. Oil is still 13.3% lower than a year back, by the way. Stocks logged a third straight week of gains after posting their worst monthly performance this year in May on fears the prolonged trade war would hit global economic growth. For the week, the S&P 500 climbed 2.2%, the Dow added 2.41%, and the Nasdaq rose 3.02%. US stocks were lower after the close on Friday, as losses in the industrials, financials and consumer services sector led shares lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dipped 0.13% to end at 26,719, while the S&P 500 lost 0.13% to end at 2,950, and the Nasdaq Composite dropped 0.24% to 8,031. The tech-heavy Nasdaq was weighed down by a 2.2% fall in PayPal holdings after the digital payments company said its chief operating officer would step down. Facebook said it was going to launch its own cryptocurrency to expand into payments. The Libra blockchain is a decentralized, programmable database designed to support a low volatility cryptocurrency. that will have the ability to serve as an efficient medium of exchange for billions of people around the world, they said. Their white paper said as Libra is a stable coin, it will have less volatility than a crypto like Bitcoin, as it's tied to the value of real world currencies. Its potential is huge. And behind it is the Libra Association, which is an independent not-for-profit membership organisation based in Geneva, Switzerland. Members of the Libra Association will consist of geographically distributed and diverse businesses, non-profit and multilateral organisations, and academic institutions, the paper said. The list of founding members includes MasterCard, PayPal and Visa, among many, many others. Libra received positive comments from the Bank of England's Mark Carney and from Jerome Powell from the Fed, and it was welcomed among the crypto communities despite being a direct alternative to the existing virtual currencies like Bitcoin. US Democrat Maxine Waters, though, expressed concerns about Facebook's past and asked for a moratorium until Congress and regulators have carried out thorough investigations on the project. And France's Minister of Finance, Bruno Le Maire, called for tighter regulations, adding that Libra would not be a sovereign currency. Additionally, a German member of the European Parliament, Markus Ferber, said that with Facebook's recent development, it could become a shadow bank. And a Russian lawmaker stated that Facebook's expected cryptocurrency would not be given preferential treatment in Russia. Going by Russia's rough relationship with the social media giant, the recent opposition to the company's project comes as no surprise. And Libra is one to watch, but the risks of tying personal confidential data with payment data should not be underestimated. On the other hand, central banks might support Libra against the likes of Bitcoin as an alternative to a central bank-backed digital currency. Facebook ended up 0.85% on Friday to 191.14, still 6.17% lower than from a year ago. Back to the overall markets, transaction volumes on the US exchanges hit a massive 8.6 billion shares compared with the average 7.0 billion shares for the full sessions over the last 20 trading days. This reflects quadruple witching as investors unwind interest in futures and options contracts prior to the end of their term. But it's been a stormy 3 months for the S&P 500 index. It's gone from all-time highs to 4 months lows and back to new all-time highs again. The question is whether it can stay long at these lofty levels. Since June the 3rd, equities have been going straight up, and on Thursday, the S&P 500 made a new lifetime high, even if only a tiny bit higher than the high set a couple of months ago. If the US and China announced a trade agreement at the G20, the markets are just going to keep rocketing higher, with 3,000 on the S&P 500 likely to be surpassed. But if there is no deal, or worse, acrimony, then the market will do what it's done three times already and simply roll away. And remember this, over the last 18 months, the market has been absolutely flooded with money. In 2018, US companies poured well over $1.1 trillion into buying back their own stocks. And in 2019, they're doing precisely the same, but at an even faster pace. Central bankers around the world have managed, intervened and blasted a fire hose of cash any time the market dared to descend even a tenth of a percent, and a hapless public has, of course, been gobbling up everything. So it's worth asking, with all these trillions and trillions of dollars that have been hurled at the market, what has it done over the past 18 months? And actually, that's easy to answer. Nothing. Despite all the wild ups and downs, the net change over time has been absolutely zilch, zero, nothing at all. The past 18 months has really been a complete waste of time and energy. The financial index is just 0.4% lower than 12 months ago at 453.5, while Goldman Sachs rose 0.17% on Friday to 196.04. The yield curve is still inverted, with the 10-year bond at 2.059 and up 0.33% on Friday, while the 3-month bond was down 0.12% to 2.11. These are signs of an expected recession ahead. The CBOE Volatility Index, which measures the implied volatility of the S&P 500 options, was up 4.41% to 1540, and the US dollar index futures was down 0.55% to 96.09. Central banks around the world had a field day this week as each seemed to want to signal rate cuts ahead. The US FOMC shifted policy stance in this week's announcement. They remained positive on the US economy, so they shifted their focus to the risks from the trade tensions and to easing global growth. In fact, 7 of the 17 committee members now see 2 cuts in 2019. The chance of a further escalation is not immaterial, and so some are looking for 100 basis points or 1% of cuts over the coming year. One key question is whether the current uncertainties only impact investment, or do they spill out beyond to employment and consumption? The US consumer, of course, is still spending for now. While the Fed certainly took center stage this week, we also received updates from the ECB, BOJ, and BOE. The ECB President Draghi delivered a surprise at the bank's annual Sinatra conference, strengthening their conditional easing bias only 2 weeks after introducing it at the June meeting. Previously, the ECB were, quote, ready to act if adverse contingencies materialize, but now the ECB holds that in the absence of improvement, such that the sustained return of inflation to our aim is threatened, additional stimulus will be required. This change of tack drew the ire of President Trump, who accused Mario D of unfairly depreciating the euro. But as expected, Draghi reiterated that the ECB targets inflation, not foreign exchange. We would add, however, that the former is in part dependent on the latter, and we sense a degree of competitive policymaking as global banks in unison turn dovish. And on that note, the Bank of Japan kept policy steady on Thursday's meeting and noted increased downside risks. They also mentioned the possibility of lowering short-term rates, increasing asset purchases, as well as adjusting their 10-year target and trading band. As with the ECB, the challenge for the Bank of Japan is establishing credibility that they have capacity to ease policy even further. Of the banks meeting this week, one major is still reluctant to join the herd. In June, the Bank of England held the bank rate at 0.75% and reiterated their mild tightening bias. A key reason for this is, unlike in Europe and in the US, headline inflation is at target, while wage growth remains above 3%. Of course, the Bank of England emphasised that policy guidance is highly provisional on a smooth outcome to Brexit. In that regard, the race to be the new UK Prime Minister has narrowed to 2, Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt, the former being the firm favourite. And Britain is due to leave the European Union on October the 31st, but so far has not secured an exit deal. And Britain should create a new body to promote a positive vision for banking and cut taxes on the industry after failing to support the sector adequately ahead of Brexit, banking trade body UK Finance's chair Bob Wigley said on Wednesday. To avoid disruption, London-based banks have moved some staff and activities to new hubs in the European Union to maintain customer links, raising questions about the capital's future clout in global finance. The government dropped its support for the finance industry's proposal for mutual recognition post-Brexit to focus instead on a more generous form of future market access to the EU than normally given to non-EU countries. I don't think it's unfair to say that since the finance crisis, and particularly during the Brexit negotiations, our sector and services generally have seen nothing like the level of strategic support and attention from government that has been granted to goods and to technology, Bob Wigley told the UK Finance's summer reception. Wigley said the government should create a new formal body made up of regulators, government officials, and the Bank of England to set out a positive national vision for the role of the finance industry. The aggregate rate of tax paid by banks in New York and Frankfurt is much lower than in London, he said. This cannot be sustainable post-Brexit without an even larger outflux of international banks than Brexit itself may deliver, Wigley said. UK finance members, like the Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyds, had to be bailed out by taxpayers during the financial crisis that ushered in years of belt tightening for millions of Britons. And as a result, the industry is considered still too unpopular for politicians to be seen supporting it, even though finance is Britain's biggest economic sector, generating an annual trade surplus of about £70 billion. With the loss of passporting on Brexit, we will need to find ways of making the UK internationally attractive if we are to retain and attract international banks here, Wigley said. Banks were not pitching for a return to pre-financial crisis-like regulation, though better coordination among regulators was needed, he said. Right now, we are seeing a multitude of new regulatory interventions being delivered by multiple regulators with, at best, insufficient coordination and, at worst, conflict, Wheely said. So the first thing this body needs to do is to ensure that regulatory initiatives are formulated and implemented with what we call effective air traffic control, prioritization, and orderly implementation. And he called for a review of rules to ease the burden on mid-tier and smaller banks, saying poor promotion of competition in the sector meant there is only one mid-tier bank with assets over £50 billion. And he singled out a letter from the Bank of England last week telling 20 small challenger banks they needed better controls, as they could underestimate the impact of a downturn on their loan books. It illustrates an embedded anti-growth, anti-competition bias within the system that a new body should correct, Wheely said. The FTSE fell 0.23% on Friday to 7,407. The FTSE Financials was down 0.10% to 703, while the Royal Bank of Scotland was down 0.92% to 215. The pound US dollar was up 0.34% to 1.2742, while the euro US dollar was up 0.68% to 1.1368. Over in Europe, Deutsche Bank continues with its overhauling moves for reviving profitability and is likely to shed 25% of the company's risky assets over the next few years. Nonetheless, these overhauling steps are anticipated to postpone some of the bank's targets, including the goal of achieving a return on tangible equity of 4% in 2019. The plan includes detailed restructuring moves as Chief Executive Officer Christian Sewing committed tough cutbacks to shareholders post failed merger talks with Commerzbank. The bank is anticipated to decrease its risk-weighted assets by 20 to 25% over the next 3 to 5 years. Notably, these assets worth around 347 billion euro as at the 31st of March 2019 will be reduced to about 260 billion euros. Another move reflects cutbacks in the US equities trading business, including prime brokerage and equity derivatives. The bank would create a bad bank, a measure used by failed UK banks post the 2008 financial crisis. The newly formed unit would hold assets worth around 50 billion euros, as Sewing is trimming its investment banking division. This includes Sewing's plan to shrink or shut down the equity and rates trading businesses outside continental Europe completely, and focus on the core transaction banking and private wealth management businesses. But of course, there are still risky derivatives there, and they are just moving the problem around. Further, the number of employees to be affected by these moves is currently uncertain. The bank is likely to reduce the headcount below 90,000 from the existing 91,463. The proposed changes are expected to be announced with the bank's six-month results in the second half of July. But this may not be enough to turn profitability around. And by the way, there are more investigations about money laundering as reported this week. Deutsche Bank ended on Friday at 6.16 and is 35.8% down from a year ago and now has a market capitalization of just 13 billion euros. Gold closed at 1,403, up 0.45% on Friday, its highest level since September 2013, and included a weekly gain of nearly 5%. It benefited this week from the Fed's change in outlook, which has fostered expectations of up to 3 rate cuts this year and driven the dollar nearly 1% lower. Plus, signs that central banks from Europe, Japan and Australia are also willing to ease policy to support a slowing economic outlook. Geopolitical tensions between US and Iran and the unresolved US-China trade dispute have increased demand for the safe haven metal. But of course, the price is being manipulated. Silver fell 1.05% to 1533 and is 4.98% lower than a year back, and copper fell 0.41% to 270. Bitcoin rose to its highest level so far this year, on hopes that increasing institutional demand will see a wave of new money enter the market as the popular crypto looks to set to test the 10,000 range. Bitcoin rose 6.24% on Friday to 10,153, up 43.28% from a year ago. The latest surge has mostly been attributed to an expected cut in supply due next year, dubbed the halving, and signs that institutional investors are beginning to increase their exposure to cryptos. Facebook's upcoming launch of its crypto has symbolized the growing interest in cryptos from institutional players, underpinning the current rally in Bitcoin, despite the direct competition it represents. Other cryptos mostly followed Bitcoin higher. And so did the Australian scene. The RBA minutes to the June meeting highlighted that the Reserve Bank believed the outlook for the Australian and global economies remained, quote, reasonable. And their justification to cut in June and the belief that a further easing in monetary policy would be appropriate in the period ahead rests on spare capacity in the labour market, which the RBA believes can be materially reduced without any risk of inflation. Well, that's a very good alibi, at least. So their economic rosy spectacles remain. The current unemployment rate is 0.7% above the RBA's revised estimate of the full employment level, which is 4.5%, while underemployment is 1.1% above the level seen post-GFC. Reaffirming that more easing is necessary to remedy the situation, the RBA Governor Lowe, in his subsequent speech on the labour market, stated that it would be unrealistic to expect that lowering interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point will materially shift the path we look to be on, and that the most recent data, including the GDP and labour market data, does not suggest we are making any inroads into the economy's spare capacity. That said, there was no real urgency in the language used for the policy outlook, with the possibility of lower interest rates simply still on the table, as the RBA seeks to achieve its medium-term objectives. Notably, there was also a further call for fiscal policy and structural reform to be used to support the economy in its time of need. The market certainly believes that the case for immediate action has been made, having now priced a 75% chance of a follow-up cut in July. But waiting until August would allow the RBA to craft their narrative better, being the month when their revised forecasts and in-depth analysis on the economy will next be delivered in the August Statement on Monetary Policy. So expect August and November cuts to 0.75%. And a further stock market run-up as a result. Speaking in Adelaide, Reserve Bank Governor said the expectation of the cut in the record low 1.25% official cash rate was not unreasonable. This is explicit talk indeed from a central banker. However, Lowe also pointed again to the limits of monetary policy effectiveness in a world where rates have been at historic lows for some years. In doing so, he was perhaps once again less dovish than the Australian dollar market overall. Of course, the RBA will attempt to fulfil its inflation mandate, and while pricing power remains weak, lower rates will remain an option. But given Australia's roaring consumer debt levels, the bar to reductions beyond a single further quarter point move may yet be higher than many markets think. And by the way, New Zealand one quarter GDP was a highlight. Growth came in at 0.6% in line with the market, but above the RBNZ's 0.4% expectation. Positive revisions were also seen, leaving annual growth at 2.5% per year. This result should be enough to see the Reserve Bank there remain on the sidelines, particularly as growth is expected to pick up. And we discussed the New Zealand situation with Joe Wilkes in our post, Do We Need a Royal Commission in New Zealand? ANZ makes the point that while there is some loosening of lending, there are structural reasons to think any home price recovery will be limited. It has simply become more difficult for house prices to rise more quickly than income for sustained periods, and income growth itself is, of course, only modest anyway. They call out two important top-down constraints likely to operate over the medium term. The first is leverage. Many are treating the slowdown in housing credit growth to the four-decade low of 3.8% as temporary, they say. But the rate of household income growth is still very modest at around 3%. Tax cuts will see that pick up closer to 4% over the second half of the year. But in order to stabilise the household debt-to-income ratio over the medium term, barring a surprising pickup in household income, credit growth just can't grow any more quickly than it is at the present. And the second point they made is affordability. The recently released ANZ CoreLogic Housing Affordability Report shows various measures of housing affordability have improved over the past year or so, but the improvement in purchase affordability has been only modest and it's been unevenly spread. On a dwelling price to income basis, for instance, affordability in Canberra and Tasmania has continued to deteriorate. Adelaide has seen no meaningful improvement and Brisbane has only become more affordable very, very recently. Affordability also needs to improve just to keep pace with the tightening in lending standards. In this sense, a given level of affordability today implies less borrower activity than it might have historically, they say. That means continuing to pull first home buyers into the market may be challenging. State government initiatives saw the number of first home buyers rise sharply in 2017, but they have since declined. ANZ Research doesn't expect a V-shaped rebound in house prices, and neither do they expect a material and sustained improvement in the flow of credit. Much of what has driven the housing adjustments over the past 2 years, they say, is permanent, affecting both supply and demand. Modest improvements in affordability, therefore, are likely to be insufficient to reduce the affordability overhang and to drive a material increase in housing demand. Now, of course, that won't stop more first-time buyer incentive schemes emerging, as did the one from the ACT this past week. From 1 July 2019, the AC government will abolish stamp duty for first home buyers earning under $160,000 a year. This policy will effectively extend the existing scheme by extending concessions from new homes only to established dwellings and vacant land. Moreover, it will replace the existing $7,000 first-time buyer grant. And given the average price is around, let's say, $590,000, stamp duty would be around $16,600, and that's now going to be waived, so that's more than the $7,000 in the existing scheme. But expect prices to rise by this amount, completely removing any advantage. These incentive schemes just do not work, but it looks very good politically. Australian home prices drifted lower this past week, according to the latest from CoreLogic. In Sydney, prices fell 0.07% over the last week, has dropped 0.07% over the last month, has dropped 1.39% over the last quarter, has dropped 10.3% annually, and is down 15% from the peak. In Melbourne over the last week, prices fell 0.1%, have fallen 0.05% over the last month, has dropped 1.2% over the quarter, is down 9.7% annually, and from peak is 11.2% lower. In Brisbane, they fell last week 0.13%, are down 0.36% over the last month, are down 1.41% over the last quarter, are down 2.5% over the last year, and are down 2.4% from the last peak. In Adelaide, they fell 0.33% over the last week, down 0.32% over the last month. They're down 0.28% over the quarter. They've risen 0.1% annually, and from peak, they're down 0.8%. In Perth, they dropped 0.25% over the last week. They've fallen 0.51% over the last month. They've dropped 2.04% over the last quarter. They've dropped 9% annually, and they're 19.6% down from peak. And so looking at the five majors, the last week they fell 0.11%. Over the last month, they fell 0.16%. Over the last quarter, they fell 1.36%. Over the last year, they've fallen 8.6%. And from peak, they're down 10.8%. So there's very little evidence here of prices beginning to recover. And we could look at it another way. These are the annual movements, again, based on the CoreLogic series. So in Sydney, we can see that prices are consistently down below 10% and are just moving sideways. In Melbourne, prices are down to a similar level and again, a little bit of sideways movement. In Brisbane, prices are continuing to fall. And in Adelaide, we're seeing price falls accelerate. Prices are continuing to fall in Perth. Little hope there, I think, in the short term for anything other than more falls. And across the five capital cities, overall, prices continue to drop. So again, if there is a bounce, we're not seeing it yet coming through in the data. And here is just one example to make the point that averages mask. Avalon Beach unit prices in postcode 2017 have fallen 19.3% in the past year, according to data from CoreLogic, and with a 29.8% rise in time on market to 74 days. But a big question now will be the trajectory of high-rise unit prices in the light of more revelations of poor quality construction. We discussed this in our Interests of the People post, Australia is full of high-rise death traps. As News.com reported, thousands of dollars are being wiped off unit values, with a $740,000 apartment in Mascot Towers now worthless. This is just the tip of a very large iceberg, as thousands of poorly built homes are out there, thanks to poor quality imported materials, shoddy construction techniques, and subpar certification. As The Conversation put it, this crisis echoes the structural failure at Opal Tower and its evacuation on Christmas Eve last year. We've seen a series of serious building failures and fires in recent years, and state and federal governments have had more than enough time to act on recommendations for better construction regulations, but instead, they're shifting blame. Although each building failure was different, the end result is the same: misery for the residents and a looming financial disaster for the owners. We expect prices to fall and, in this segment of the market, to stall. Auction clearance rates were a little higher last week, according to CoreLogic, with a weighted average clearance of 61.8%. That's the highest since the 6th of May 2018. But as CoreLogic correctly said, while clearance rates have seen some improvement over the last few weeks, volumes are still tracking lower year on year, with 2,002 homes taken to market over the same week last year, when 52.4% of properties cleared. And the numbers are robbery at best. Really, there is still little evidence of a bounce, although some WEGs are now calling it a dead cat bounce. We will see. And CoreLogic has released new data showing that annual rental growth across Australia is stuck at a historical low 0.4% nationally, with rents across the combined capitals actually falling by 0.1% in the year to May. Sydney was down 2.9% and Darwin was down 5.2%. And these were the main drivers of the falling growth across the combined capital cities. That said, because prices have fallen far more than rents, rental yields improved in the year to May, albeit they remain poor in Sydney and Melbourne, which still remain way overvalued. And APRA released their quarterly stats to March 2019 this week. One figure which stood out was the average mortgage loan, which is $277,000, now up from $269,000 a year ago. APRA only reports each loan separately, so if you split your mortgage between fixed and variable, for example, each will be reported separately, reducing the average balance. This was disclosed in a recent written reply by APRA to the Senate Economic Committee. They do not look at total household financial footprints at all. Of course, we do. And the average mortgage outstanding is not $277,000, but $376,000, which changes the risk profile considerably. That's more evidence of APRA's myopic viewpoint. And also on APRA, the AFR reported first that Westpac had unleashed a fresh wave of property lending by relaxing serviceability conditions on low-risk home loans, immediately increasing the borrowing capacity of aspiring homeowners by as much as 8%. A spokesman for Westpac confirmed the policy change, saying credit officers would now have the discretion to approve principal interest loans to owner-occupiers who previously fell just outside lending parameters. APRA, of course, proposed possible revisions to its guidance on the serviceability assessments that authorised depository institutions, ADIs, perform on residential mortgage loan application. ADIs will be permitted to review and set their own minimum interest rate floors for use in serviceability assessments rather than using a 7% mandated floor. But then the AFR reported that Westpac had made an abrupt about-face, reinstating a key lending restriction on Thursday night after incurring the prudential regulator's wrath by removing it without approval earlier in the week. Westpac infuriated the prudential regulator after it went rogue and released a handbrake on residential property lending that has been in place across all Australian banks since 2014. A spokesman for the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority said it was surprised a Big Four bank had lowered the serviceability floor before a consultation process designed to refine the standard had been completed. Not that it really matters, but due process must be seen to be done. Credit taps will be opened soon enough. Westpac just got trigger happy. And so to the markets. The ASX 100 was down 0.55% on Friday to 5,500, and that's up 9% from a year ago. The ASX Financials Index was down 0.7% to 6,361, and the Local Volatility Index was down 1.9% to 1278. ANZ was down 1.18% to 2854. CBA was down 0.78% to 82.24. NAB was down 0.41% to 26.85. And Westpac was down 0.6% to 28.23. Among the regionals, the Bank of Queensland was down 0.52% to 9.53. Bendigo and Adelaide Bank was down 0.52% to 11.59. Suncorp was down 0.59% to 13.57. Macquarie was down 1.04% to $126. AMP ended at 2.07. And lenders and mortgage insurance, Genworth, ended up 0.7% to 289. McGrath was down 2% to 24.5 cents. Yellow Brick Road was down 2.86% to 6.8 cents. And Mortgage Choice was down 1.33% to 1.11. The Aussie US rate ended up 0.09% to 69.28 as both currencies weakened on expectations of lower interest rates ahead. The Aussie Gold Cross reached a record high of 2020, up 0.74%, and the Aussie Bitcoin Cross was up 5.72% on Friday to 14,699, up, wait for it, 48% from a year ago. So as rates are cut and money pumped into the economies around the world, we can expect stock prices to go higher and other assets inflate further. Central banks have capitulated to the lower for longer doctrine, and QE is happening even as we speak. But this is not good for real people in the real economy. It is not encouraging real investment in real businesses, despite supporting the banking system and its market participants. As the race to the bottom continues, expect shares, gold and Bitcoin to go higher still, and higher for a time until the Great Reset finally hits. Timing is uncertain, but the probability of it hitting in due course is 100%. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.